myself. So before I introduce the book, and it's kind of hard to introduce a book when I would suspect that almost none of you have read it, I wanted to say something about my trajectory and what brought me to write that last book. So for most of my career, I was a normal historian in the sense that I would look at the subject, I would ask questions about it, I would go and find archival documents to answer this question, and then I would answer it in a book. So I first was interested in how administration works in the early modern period, in particular in colonial domains, so I had a series of books on that. And then I was wondering in that book, in Defining Nations, how do people become members of the communities, and when do they stop being members, when they're kind of expelled from them? And this is the book, Defining Nation, which I look at these processes of integration and expulsion from communities, and obviously centering also on immigrants or people who move, which are easier to detect how these processes happen, though also speaking about people who were always resident in the communities, because they sometimes can be also expelled from the community because of something, and I was asking why and how these processes happen in early modern Spain and Spanish America. And then the last book, I was wondering about how national territories got formed over time. So I looked at all these processes in which people say, this is mine, this is yours, and how they defend and how this discussion takes place and how it eventually leads to the formation of territories. What was common to all these pursuits was that I had a question in mind, that I looked for archival material to answer it, but also that I was looking at law not by looking at legislation or doctrinal writing of how does this happen, but I was looking at practices on the ground and trying to figure out from all these thousands of interactions that I was looking what the rules were. So it was a bit like being a linguist that looks at how people speak and then trying to tease from the way people speak the rules of language. So that's the way that I was thinking about law, and this is how I was practicing my type of legal history. And then once I understood what made people react the way they did, I was looking at what they did, I was looking at what they said, whether it is about belonging to the community or whether it is about territorial boundaries, I would look then at legislation and doctrine to see, is there a relationship, what is the relationship? Because, of course, people on the ground seldom cite. They seldom even know why they're doing maybe what they are, but they know that that's the right way to do stuff. So this has been my interest so far. But as I was doing it, and I've been doing it now for 20 years, I kept on bumping against something that I was feeling was a misdialogue between historians and people who do law. Law has this weird quality in which we use language, so it seems very penetrable in a way that maybe most of us do not think about mathematics or science in the same way. We know we don't understand it, those of us who are not mathematicians or scientists. We look at it with amazement, we know it's foreign to us. Law speaks a language that sounds familiar, that sounds normal. And historians often read it and they know what it means because it's so simple. But it isn't. It has its rules, it has its ways of understanding these terms. Terms that seem innocent, in fact, are embedded and are really important. I recall a conversation years ago when I was at the University of Chicago with a student who was working on the death penalty. And he was citing a decision by the Supreme Court of Mexico in which the question of intent came up. And of course, for him, intent was what is this person intended to do. And I stopped him and I said, no, you know, criminal law intent, this is a huge thing. These judges have read all this discussion about what is intent, how do you prove it, why it is important, how you replace it, what happens when it's missing, what kind of presumptions you can, there's a whole thing behind it. He said, no, the judges don't say that. And I said, fine. That was the end of the conversation. But that's an extreme case, but very often I have come across it. So as I'm somewhere between lawyers and I teach in law schools, but I'm also in history, I also saw the lawyer side in which I think jurists very often understand that norms change over time. Obviously the way we celebrate contracts today is not the way they were done 2,000 years ago. But they tend to think about law as something that is always the same. So the norms change, but law as a system, as a way of interacting, of where it comes from, not always they're sensitive to how different it is. A judge said something 500 years ago, says now, even if he says the same thing, in fact, it's completely different because the context in which he's speaking, or she, now today it's she also, are so different. So I was really surprised by how many of my colleagues in the law school, both at Harvard and at Stanford actually, were not really aware of the context embeddedness of law, that it's not enough to read the law, you have to really understand what part this particular thing is doing within a larger system. So I ended up writing this book. And I've had it on my mind for about 10 years until I actually sat down to write it. And as I told Regina, I was asked to write a little short text to a handbook on the history of Spanish-American colonial law. I said, I'll try. But once I succeeded to do it in 20 pages, I said, yeah, I can do European law now. I know how to do it. I know how to say something brief about something so huge and so varied. I think I can see the way through. So this is what I try to do here. To write a book that would appeal to both to jurists and historians, and actually giving really a roadmap. I don't pretend to say everything possible. I'm just pretending to say there is a way to look through this huge chaos and diversity and say something that is meaningful. That was my intent. So let me tell you more about that book. I prepared the text because I think it guarantees that I say what I want to say, and then we can talk. Okay, so I began this book with a series of questions in mind. Questions about the law. Does European law have a single history or various? Can we tell a history of the development of law in Europe that is coherent yet recognizes the wide variety of systems and solutions across the continent? But I also had questions about Europe. Can legal historians adopt the convention that Europe is an idea rather than a continent? If this were the case, what would the results be? Which places and what themes should be included and which omitted from a book on the history of European law? Finally, I had a question about the usefulness of legal history. Does legal history matter? Is it a pure entertainment, or does it help us understand something important? Is it useful for historians? Is it useful for jurists, for the general public? What do we stand to gain from knowing more about our legal past? What can it tell us about the present and perhaps even the future? So to highlight some of these questions, I begin this book with a true story about a conversation I had a few years ago in class at Harvard with an American undergraduate student. The student had told me that she had just visited Washington, D.C., where she saw, and I cite her, a copy of our great Charter of Liberties, the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta, as some of you may know, all of you, was a charter granted by King John of England in 1215 to a group of barons. It was constantly invoked and confirmed in the following years, decades, and centuries. And at the end of the 16th century and during the 17th century, that is some 450 years after it was given by King John, many, although not all, read the Magna Carta as if it was a charter that set limitation of what the English kings could do. In some odd way, it was comprehended then, in the late 16th and 17th century, as a document listing the rights of subjects, and was heralded, as it still does today, my student is a proof, for recognizing important rights such as the right to trial by jury, no taxation without representation, and so forth. So not wanting to undermine my student's enthusiasm, I asked myself, what do I do? How can I explain to this student that what she saw in Washington, D.C. was an English feudal document whose original intent had nothing to do with what it came to symbolize, a charter of fundamental rights? King John would have been appalled if he thought this was the case. A document whose importance was acquired over time because centuries after it was enacted, it was given a new meaning and a new role. A document that in no way was directly related to what transpired in the British colonies, in the 13 British colonies in North America that became the US, or that had any relevance to the story of the young US Republic after its independence. So the question I first had to tackle was whether this mattered at all. Was it significant that the 21st century undergraduate American student misread an early 13th century document such as the Magna Carta? What would this student stand to learn had she understood what the Magna Carta really was, why and how it had come to acquire the status it presently has, how this status crossed the Atlantic and gained importance in the US? Was this history relevant to her present-day concerns? Was myth-breaking as important as myth-making? Is the past a thing gone, or does it tell us something essential about the present and the future? Understanding the 13th century Magna Carta appropriately would entail remembering a feudal past in which powerful lords searched to protect their jurisdiction and property against an expanding monarchy. It would also require imagining how society changed over time, that is, how the privileges of a few barons became the rights of all Englishmen, and how in the process claims for rights could limit what the kings could legitimately do. Given its projection in the US, this narrative would also need to include an explanation of how these ideas crossed the Atlantic and mutated there. Within a larger history of European law, the explanation would have to engage with the question not only why the Magna Carta had acquired this mythical status, but also why similar feudal documents so abundant, so frequent elsewhere in Europe, did not. What was so particular about the English legal system and political system to make a feudal document given to a few barons so central to political and legal debates in the 17th century and thereafter? Why was the Magna Carta chosen to carry this enormous burden? What were the consequences of this choice? Why were other documents not selected? So to properly understand the Magna Carta, I reasoned, one would have to comprehend not only, not even mainly, what it dictated. While the text itself remained surprisingly stable despite constant copying and confirmation, what continuously changed was the legal context in which it was read. That the Magna Carta came to symbolize what it does today, that my student was so proud at having seen a copy, thus had nothing to do with the text itself and everything to do with the context, or rather various contexts in plural, in which it was read. If we wish to understand what the Magna Carta stood for in each given moment, we therefore would need to reconstruct the various systems in which it operated. As a legal historian, therefore, I know that what the Magna Carta currently stands for had nothing to do with it and everything to do with how it was used and remembered. If my student knew this history, I reasoned, she might understand the past better, but she might also acquire means to imagine differently her present and future. It would supply her with instruments to question narratives, to understand the processes that led for their formation, and to comprehend that the roads we have taken in the past and still are taking in the present are never evident nor foretold. The Magna Carta, of course, is only one but many of the legal remnants that still determine our present or allow us to imagine our future. Plenty of other instruments, institutions, and texts inherited from the past fulfill that role. Both relics of a time gone and important features of our everyday life, they give things certain meanings, they supply solutions, and they offer techniques through which to analyze and understand reality. Take another example, legal presumptions, which were a Roman invention allowing to assume the existence of things without having to prove them first. Not only was the employment of presumption a Roman technique, but some of the presumption we still use today originated in Roman times. One of the most powerful, most quotidian of those, to the point that we forget that it even exists, is the legal presumption that children born to a married couple are the natural offsprings of both spouses. This presumption allows registering children as offsprings without their parents having to prove their descent. This is the way it still operates today, right? Essentially, in order to avoid lengthy processes and litigation, this presumption survived for some 2,000 years and still fulfills this function today, despite the existence of scientific procedures allowing us to establish with certitude and with quick and reliable procedures who are the true parents of the recently born. While this permanence may not be altogether surprising, some things remain the same without us noticing them. Here, too, the contexts in which the presumption was used and still operates can dramatically change its meaning as well as its functions. Implemented under radically different social conditions, this presumption could come to fulfill a completely different role. In present-day Spain, for example, it authorizes to register a child born to a gay couple that is legally married as the natural offsprings of both same-sex spouses. So a completely different use of this presumption. To explain how such things happen and why we need to understand them, I wanted to write a book that would highlight the constructed character of law as well as its context dependency. For me, the history of legal developments in Europe featured the continuous construction and reconstruction of the normative order and the continuous working and reworking of past traditions to the point in which on occasion they completely betrayed their original design. And again, I'm thinking about what King John would have said about the claims we make today about the Magna Carta, or what would the Romans think about the use of the legal presumption in present-day Spain. So, contrary perhaps to many of my colleague legal historians, what the law I was targeting was not a body of learned law, which evolved with certain stability over time in a closed space restricted to the continent by professionals we came to identify as jurists. This is the way most legal historians think about legal history. Neither was I interested in the development of legal doctrines or institutions. Instead, I sought to reproduce the political, social, and cultural roots of law, as well as to narrate how law influenced society. Because this was my intention, the story I wanted to tell was necessary a long jure story, which is why the 2.5 millennia. It's a story which begins with the Roman Empire that, of course, took on many elements from preceding systems, most particularly the Hellenistic world, and which, like evolution, still continues today. So I end this book with what would happen next. These are the problems we currently face, without giving an answer, of course, because I don't know where evolution takes us. As I often argue in this book, in this long, complex, and hazardous trajectory, and in their quest to obtain certain goals, agents propelling legal developments often played with continuity and change. They argued, and of course I talk about continuity and change because this is what historians do, right? They look to change over time. They argued for continuity when they innovated. So agents sometimes say this is continuity, but in fact it's innovation. But they also clamored for change when in reality they allowed for none. So both things exist. The most striking example of this kind of malleability, that is the difference between what one does and what one says in the field of law, is the dissimilarity between developments in 17th century England, 18th century British colonies in North America, and 18th century France. So let me talk about these three examples very briefly and how they treat change versus continuity. So in England, during the 17th century, I argue in this book, English jurists adopted a new, completely new vision of their political and legal system, undertaking what some historians have identified as a true revolution. There's a long, big debate whether the 17th century England is a revolution or not, but many think it is. Before this period, before the jurists elaborated these new ideas about the English legal system, it was generally agreed among lawyers working in England that common law was a system of royal courts that was imposed by the Norman kings, who were foreign occupiers in England, in order to dominate both their lords and the colonial population. This was what common law was, a system of royal courts imposed by the Normans to dominate the colonial situation in England. In the late 16th and in the 17th century, however, English jurists began arguing that common law was completely a different affair. They now imagined it as a system of customary procedures and solutions that evolved over time, having begun before the Normans arrived and continued thereafter without any major change. So a completely different vision of what common law is. 17th century English jurists did even more than that. They began to argue that common law courts were the most important courts in England, because all other jurisdiction and legal system in existence in England were subjected to the principle and jurisdiction of common law. So they made common law be the law of England. This too was a completely new invention, as I talk about it in my book. Before this was coined, common law was not the only legal system in England. There was a plurality of other courts and system feudal courts, local courts, merchant courts, ecclesiastical courts, eventually also courts of equity. Not only was common law one jurisdiction among many that existed on the island, until the 17th century, it was not the most frequently used, was not the most dominant, was not the most important, and the other courts were not at all subjected to it. I will return to it in a second. The point I'd like to make here at this moment is that despite introducing major innovation that completely changed the meaning of English law and the place of common law within the system and what common law was, those proposing this new interpretation never presented their work as revolutionary. God forbid. Instead, they insisted that they are upholding old traditions, which they claim the king has refused to comply and follow with. So it's complete inversion. In the 13 American colonies, the same thing happens. In fact, the actors who proclaimed their independence equally argued that they were more respectful of their tradition than the king was, and it was in the name of continuity, not change, that they were forced to rebel. And I mentioned that too. However, the system they produced in the late 18th century had important elements of rupture. It was certainly not a continuity. And eventually, you know, the Americans would come to think of that as an American revolution, but that's not completely consensual either. Contrary to 17th century English jurists and 18th century American lawyers who were really the ones propelling the American independence, in the late 18th century, French revolutionaries heralded change. We all know that. They made a revolution. They call it this way. Many, if not all, argued for the need to completely overhaul the social order and the legal and political system. The need to toss out all pre-existing legal sources and relying no longer on traditional solution, only on reason and general will. And this is one of the themes that come up in the book too. They suggested, in fact, that their actions were so radical that they should begin a new age. And in fact, they call their calendar with a new name, it's a new age after the revolution. Yet, of course, the French system that emerged as a result had incredibly strong elements of continuity rather than break. So other examples are just as telling. This is, I think, one of the clear things that one can draw when one studies the history of European law over time, that you cannot trust actors when they talk about change and continuity. One can ask, for example, whether the so-called discovery of Roman law in medieval Europe, in medieval European universities, was a continuity, as actually contemporary jurists pretended that they're continuing, or extremely revolutionary, as many of us imagine it today. They said it was continuity, we think it was revolutionary. Or alternatively, were the 16th century legal humanists that pretended to return to the good old Roman law, in fact did. And I speak about all these things more in the book, of course. Or whether German 19th century codification movement indeed recollected the customary laws of the German territories or revolutionized them to the point that they could hardly be recognized, which is part of what present-day German jurists say. Because regardless of what actors say, continuity and change probably tend to coincide in all systems. To understand the past, we need to know not only what had transpired, but also how it was reconstructed, used, and comprehended by both contemporaries who lived through these processes, but also future interpreters that look back at them in order to reform their present and their future. Over the course of its long history, in short, law was elaborated, re-elaborated, and worked once again, as different individual communities and institutions sought to identify, construct, reconstruct, manage, re-manage the basic rules that would regulate their activities. As they looked back to the past, they both adopted and rejected it, which is why we need to know legal history, I would argue, in order to understand what had really transpired. So if these were my intention, how did I carry them out? My strategy in this book was to address some of the topics I found most compelling while also incorporating illustrative details. Obviously, this meant putting emphasis on some aspects, places, and times, and omitting others. I know that no expert will find all of his or her preferred topic adequately represented, and no historian would think that his or her period or country are sufficiently covered. And in fact, as I mentioned to Regina, the one blog that I found today was really complaining that I didn't include the Hammurabi tables and Greek law, which is probably right, but you know, there's a limit to what one can do. I mean, anyway, so there was one angry person there that I didn't. As with all storytelling, I was forced to select what to include and what to omit, and rather than surveying all of the existing system or counting countries in order to ensure full coverage of Europe, I chose what best illustrated my story and best explained what I wanted to show. I start with Roman law. So this is my answer to this blogger. Because of its enduring influence over legal developments in Rome, in Europe, sorry. Roman law, Goethe once said, is like a diving duck. Whether you saw it or not, it was always there. After I briefly surveyed Roman law, I observed the expansion of Roman tradition as a byproduct of the spread of Christianity and of the creation of a Latin Christendom. I follow by examining the influence of the so-called Germanic traditions. There is a discussion there whether there was a Germanic tradition, one, various, none. It's this thing that historians now discuss. That led to what I perceive as Germanification of Roman law or Romanization of German law. I continue by studying the use, reuse, invention, and reinvention of these three pillars of European law, Roman, canon, and Germanic. In the Middle Ages and the early modern period, in both continental Europe and in England, I characterize these periods, the Middle Ages and early modernity, as periods which featured a colossal struggle to unite hundreds of local arrangements into a systematic jus commune, as it would be called in the continent, or common law, as it would be called in England. And I discuss the degree by which this endeavor succeeded or failed. I then trace the transformation of these traditions and their use with the emergence of the modern state and stronger monarchical orders, as well as the opposition this generated. I examine how the end of the old regime affected the law, how did the age of revolutions with its Atlantic dimensions, and what happened because of the rise of the nation state and the coming to power of the middle classes. I end by briefly examining some of the central issues of today's legal scholarship, legal globalization, to the fact that law is escaping the nation state in several ways, and in Europe, the creation and viability of a new legal order led by the growth of European institutions. So it's very, particularly here, it's important. Aside from the vast and continuing influence, as well as reformation, restatement, and reinvention of Roman law, one of the central themes of this book is the wish to reconstruct the multiple and potentially conflicting legal orders that coexisted in Europe in each given moment. In each period, I argue, there were several interpretive methods, political norms, favored sources, leading personal and dominant jurisdictions. The interplay between these various elements led to extreme multi-normativity. To return to English law, today we tend to identify it with common law. This is my easiest target because really I think the legal history of England allows to do a lot because it's so particular. So today we tend to identify English law with common law. However, as I mentioned before, until the 17th century and according to some scholars, perhaps the 18th, even 19th century, alongside common law were many other legal systems existed in England, local courts, feudal courts, ecclesiastical courts, courts of equity, merchant courts, and so forth. Common law, therefore, was not the only legal system that operated, and it was hardly the most important one. Common law was applied only by royal courts that dealt with very few cases and were open only to subjects who could and wanted to afford litigating in them. Throughout the Middle Ages and even the early modern period, the number of judges sitting in common law courts was usually extremely small. They could normally be counted with the fingers of both hands. So this is the big common law system we talk about. Contrary to the continent, where a legal pyramid existed and legal decisions could normally, if license was granted, be appealed to the king's highest courts, such was not the case in England. So common law was not an appeal court of the king. For example, there was no appeal from feudal courts to the king's common law courts, and neither could the judges of common law force other courts to relinquish their jurisdiction and pass the matter to them. Part of what I tell in the book, therefore, is the story of how common law came to dominate, indeed even symbolize and stand for the entire legal system. When did this happen and what were the results? So when did we move from multi-normativity in England to a lesser multi-normativity? It still exists, but it's much lesser. Multi-normativity, however, was not particular to England. In continental Europe, multiple legal orders and possibilities also existed. and why certain became more dominant than others is a question to ask rather than a foretold story to tell. To take another paradigmatic example, so again, I'm taking, in the book, I often take very easy targets to explain what I want to say. So I take here the division French lawyers make between pays de droit écrit and pays de droit coutumier, so country, parts of France that are of written law and parts of France that are of customary law. This division that is said to have partitioned France into a northern half or two-thirds that followed customary law and a southern half or a third more or less, which was heavily influenced by Roman law, indicates apparently to legal pluralism. Yet in the French case, this pluralism was much more complex than meets the eye. We now know that the writing down of the so-called customary laws of France began in the 13th and 14th century. Initially championed as a private enterprise of particular jurists, by the 15th and 16th century, royal authorities started fostering these processes. They initiated campaigns to write down the customary laws and sent jurists to oversee these campaigns. Royal commissions who undertook the compilation of the French so-called customary law left ample evidence proving that rather than considering themselves as recorders charged with locating and identifying existing norms, they sought to influence these norms. These officials decided what to write down and what to ignore. They homogenized the customs of different regions, and they extended the validity of those customary norms they considered particularly useful throughout the realm. So we actually have cahiers of these jurists that tell us how they're doing it, how they're transforming the customary law rather than just writing it down. By the end of this process, the so-called customary law of France was no longer dependent on local creation, nor was it oral, as customary law traditionally is. Instead, it now existed in written form, which had the power of law because the king declared it was law. So the power of this customary law was no longer the community, it was the king recognizing there is a customary law, and therefore, now written down, this is the customary law of France. Furthermore, or the different parts of France. Furthermore, the jurists who were responsible for this transformation from customary to royal, from oral to written, were all trained in Roman law. And the text they produced referenced the terms, techniques, and structure of Roman law. If this was not enough, after the customs were codified, they became subject to academic comment and interpretation, of course, by professional university-trained jurists. Thus, if the specific contents of this customary law was on occasions inspired by old traditions, which sometimes it was, after its compilation, law in the pays de droit coutumier was no longer truly a customary law. Meanwhile, in the French territories that allegedly followed Roman law, a plurality of local customs were also in existence. So there was a customary law there too. Roman law allowed, even encouraged such a thing. It recognized customs as a valid legal source. Even there, as Voltaire had once argued, a man that voyages changes law as many times as he changes horses. As a result, it seems fair to say that the idea that some parts of France followed Roman law and others customary law, and this is a canonical interpretation mostly starting in 16th and 17th century France, was a distinction that made sense politically, but not necessarily reflected reality, at least not legal reality. The question a legal historian must therefore ask him or herself is why was it coined? What was at stake for the jurist coining this difference to make it? Who made it, for what end, and what influence did it have on developments in France later on? So if multinormativity was one central issue I wanted to address in this book, I hope I do, another was scholarly disagreement. Although I wanted to write an introductory essay and did my best to avoid heavy erudite style with legal technicalities, use clear direct prose that would be accessible, I also wanted to signal the difficulties we face in reconstructing what had transpired in the past as legal historians. Sometimes it is difficult to reconstruct the past because there are no sources. Other times, because we're not sure how to read these sources. Sometimes because these sources involve the mediation of too many people, so we find it hard to divide who did what and in which period. Sometimes because these texts were buried under multiple layers of use and interpretation. It's really hard to return to do archaeology of knowledge, as Foucault would say. But whatever the case is, and although we do our best to reconstruct the past as truthfully as we can, there are still things we think we know and things we certain we don't know. Things we can agree on and things we continue to discuss. Take, for example, feudalism. So that's another easy target. Was there a feudal period? And if so, what did it include? Traditionally, there are many theories, and of course, feudalism became very central to European debates, especially in the 16th and 17th century, when, or even before, when people talk about consent for governments and mutual relationship between rulers and people. So even before, actually. So it became, in early modern Europe, it's a very big thing, feudalism, because it's supposed to be the origin of the idea of contract between rulers and ruled, the way jurists had talked about feudalism. So for legal history, feudalism is both important and an easy target. So if there was a feudal period, what did it include? So traditionally, there were many theories about what feudalism was and how and why it had emerged. Historians have also suggested that though affecting many areas in Europe, it was not practiced identically everywhere and may not have constituted a system the way it was once portrayed by early researchers. For many decades, historians have also been aware of the fact that much of what we know about feudalism comes from descriptions that were written after it was already undergoing change and decline, and that those describing it, mostly in the 12th and 13th century, had their own motive to present it in particular ways. We know all that. Yet, while some historians concur that in the 8th, 9th, and 10th century, perhaps even 11th century, many parts of Europe shared several fundamental characteristics which they identify as feudals, others completely dismiss it. So there's a big debate whether there was feudalism. For those believing in the existence of feudalism, it is important because it consisted precisely of what I just said briefly, of personal relations of dependency between powerful individual lords and subject populations, vassals. Relation that featured unequal exchanges, but mutual. The lords protected and cared for the vassals, and these in return had to be loyal and obedient and give their lord aid, service, and advice. So this is basically the base on which jurists constructed the early modern state, right? For those dismissing feudalism, so those who say there was no feudalism, such relations never existed in Europe. They go so far. These historians suggest that the institutions once described as feudal were only a model that rarely, if ever, was put into place. According to them, the large variety of situations and practices they uncover in the archives can never be reduced to a system with clear principles, as scholars of feudalism once suggested. For those contesting the existence of feudalism, therefore, feudalism was a theoretical abstraction invented by later generation, that an abstraction that obscured rather than enhanced our understanding of the past. So as legal historians, what are we to make of such debate? Is it relevant to legal history? How do they modify our understanding of the development of law in Europe? Can legal historians disregard this debate and still claim that feudalism was important to the construction of the early modern state? So I'd like to separate it and say, the question whether feudalism reflected social, political, or economic realities, or was it a mere juridical invention, does matter for historians. However, I find that as important is the observation that these historians make, that in the 11th, 12th, and 13th century, jurists across Europe, which we called feudalists, so experts in feudal law, invented feudalism. Because by looking back to the past, they wanted to find solutions to the needs of the present. I think these observations that have really revolutionized medieval studies, and they still fight over whether feudalism existed or not, was important historically, but for legal historians, it borders with triviality. Legal historians know that this is how jurists do things, right? Law develops because scholars and lawyers constantly think through, rework, and argue about the past. Usually not in order to understand it faithfully, but in order to sustain claims in the present. This is precisely what distinguishes them from historians, at least who theoretically care about the past on its own merit. Jurists recruit the past for their own needs. If multi-normativity and multiple interpretation, as well as the doubts we have regarding what truly happened in the past, was one message I wanted to stress. Another overriding preoccupation which I wanted to tackle was the common assumption that common law and civil law, English and continental law, were two completely separate and distinct systems. This assumption is central to all narratives of the development of law in Europe. It is shared by most jurists and not jurists, both continental and English, and it features massively in debates regarding European law, wherever I was reading for the chapter on European, the law of the European Union community, common market community union, the issue of how can we do that because common law and continental law came up. So legal historians who have studied the foundational period of the English common law, of course, have long affirmed that it had continental roots. They all know that, that it starts with continental law. A few even gone as far as highlighting the continuing mutual influence between continental and common law. All this exists in the literature. Yet the histories of European law still focus either on English or on the continental system. When they describe both, as in the most recent The History of Law in Europe, an introduction by Bart Waters and Marco De Benito, they do so separately. In the above-mentioned book, half of the text deals with continent and is by one author, and the other half deals with England and is by the other author. Indeed, both systems are included in that book, but they're included in distinct parts and no effort is made to link them together. They are like two pillars that may sustain a roof, Europe, but the one never touches the other. They're parallel. So rather than following this route, in this book I wanted to demonstrate that both the English and continental law form part of the very same legal tradition. So I expect this book would annoy English lawyers, and I hope so. That was my declared attempt. Their specific technologies or solutions may have varied to some degree or the other, but they shared a common genealogy that bound them together more strongly than what drew them apart. In order to demonstrate this point, I adopt an analysis that observes both the English and continental law at the same time by using the same methodology. I examine the formative period of continental jus commune alongside the formative period of common law. It happens at the same time, and as I argue, they're because of the same processes and needs. I then analyze how both systems respond to similar challenges and change in the early modern period, and I explain if the change is different, why I think it happened, that they reacted differently. I compare their 18th century mutations and revolutions, and I scrutinize them throughout the 19th century and into the formation of the European Union in the second half of the 20th century. Both legal systems, I demonstrate, took strikingly similar routes, more or less at the same time, among other things because they often responded to similar pressures in comparative ways. In comparable ways. These routes led them to moments of unity, greater unity, and moments of greater divergence. But divergence was often more apparent than real. Rather than foreign to each other, as previous authors have concluded, the English common law and the continental civil law, as far as I was concerned, form part of a single European tradition from which they both drew as well as enriched. As if two dancers in a tango, the story of one cannot, rather than two pillars, the story of one cannot be told without the story of the other. The last issue that was central to my narrative was the wish to examine how European law had acquired the large resonance it currently has, and why it had influenced large territories and many societies outside Europe. My aim was not to advocate for a Eurocentric narrative that would pretend that this dominance was the natural result of accomplishments, perhaps even superiority, of this law vis-à-vis non-European legal systems. Instead, I traced the way European law came to refashion itself as both the epitome of reason and as a system with potential universal applicability. I argue that the enormous influence European law has had around the globe could, of course, be explained by political and economic factors, but it also required an intellectual elaboration. Ancient Romans had already linked community membership to law and both to the extension of political hegemony, but this link mutated dramatically in the Middle Ages. The propagation of Christianity allowed exporting European law to new areas in Asia, Africa, and Europe. With the advent of colonialism, new explanations were adopted to justify the imposition of European law on non-European territories. The same thing happened during the 18th century revolutions and the 19th century construction of the nation-state, when European legal systems were presented as instruments that were identified with rationality, that was said to be universal. At the time, they believed it was a single nationality. And they, and when they came to represent the aspiration of a growing middle class. So these were my goals. What were my conclusions? Of course, posing the question this way, I'm cheating because already my methodology and premises contain not only hypotheses but also conclusions. The presence of multinormativity, the constant elaboration and re-elaboration of what things meant, the constant gaze to the past in order to not to preserve it but to change its meaning, the growing claim for universality, the features that tied continental and English law together, and so forth. However, let me answer this question, what my conclusions were, and end this presentation, also by returning to the point of departure, that is my initial inquiry. As you may remember, I asked three questions. Does European law have a single history, and if so, what is it? Where is European law, and does your legal history matter? So here are very brief answers to these questions. Does European law have a single history? The answer, of course, yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written that. If one traces how European society has evolved over time and how law enabled this evolution as well as was modified because of it, one sees a clear story in which multiple agents constantly looked to the past in order to reform their present. They struggled over what law was, who could make it, but they also debated which were the legitimate sources of law, how to hierarchize them. Divine law, customary law, and law made by authority all coexisted peacefully, and they were examined by a plethora of experts. Some of these experts were reputed to discover, tell, or make the law. Others were said to interpret and apply it, though it was not really clear that discovery, telling, making, interpreting, and applying were necessarily distinct. Law was contingent on context, and different solutions were proposed and adopted according to what was considered possible and what was considered just. Roman law may have been the diving duck that Goethe once said, but it dove in both continental and English waters, changed colors and shapes so often, so much, that it was no longer clear whether it was a duck at all, and if so, which type of duck. Where is European law? As I already mentioned, to tell the story of development of law in Europe, I think it is essential we observe both continent and England as skewed mirrors of one another and as two dancers in a tango. If I return to my imagery before, both the developments in one cannot be understood without developments in the other. The study of colonialism and colonial law is just as important. In fact, I have chapters there about that. The colonies were not only recipients of European legal traditions, they were also incubators of new ideas and trends that helped reshape European law, sometimes profoundly. While some of these developments happened overseas in the colonies themselves, others transpired in Europe because of Europe's engagement with the colonial expansion. So my last question is, does legal history matter? And this I leave for you to decide.
Thank you very much for this tour de force.